From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And for the second time this week, the fatal shooting of a black man by police officers has been videotaped, and this time live streamed on a cell phone by a stunningly calm, or maybe shocked, LaVeesh Reynolds. She began streaming on Facebook just after her boyfriend, 32-year-old Philando Castile, was shot.
And she says on the tape that they'd been pulled over for a broken taillight, that Castile told the officer he was licensed to carry a gun and was reaching for his license when he was shot. And a warning, this tape is very difficult to listen to.
He just shot his arm off. We got pulled over on Larpiner.
I told him not to reach for it. I told him to get his hand off it.
You told him to get his ID, sir, and his driver's license. Oh, my God, please don't tell me he's dead.
We are going to be reporting on that story today, but we start in Baton Rouge, where the Justice Department has started an investigation into Tuesday's shooting of 37-year-old Alton Sterling. He was tasered, then pinned down by officers who yelled that he had a gun and shot him. There's now a second video. It was taken by a shop owner who knew Sterling. It is also very difficult to listen to.
Hey, boy.
Edmund Jordan is a state representative in Baton Rouge and a spokesman for Alton Sterling's family. Representative Jordan, your thoughts first on this new video.
The new video sheds a different light. If you listen to the first video, at least when I listened to it, I only heard four shots, but it had been reported that there were up to six shots. And if you listen to the second video, you can hear those two extra shots. So to shoot someone six times at point blank range, it's very disturbing.
Others who have viewed the tape, the Daily Beast, for instance, they say that it doesn't support the officer's claim that Sterling's gun represented a threat. It appears to have been in his pocket. But this is the kind of thing that will be investigated by the Justice Department. Meanwhile, what does the family want to see?
Ultimately, the family wants to see justice. They want to see the truth come out and justice. And we believe that both videotapes speak for themselves. And I think people can clearly see that Alton was not posing any threat to the officers. If that was a gun that actually came out of his pocket, he was not reaching for that. It was not immediately accessible to him.
But Representative Jordan, do you, the family, have any sympathy for the officers, given that there had been a 911 call that somebody was wielding a gun? Again, the shop owner said Alton Sterling was not flashing his gun. Other reports say that there was a homeless man who had asked him for money and he had displayed a gun. But in any event, the police officers arrived. They are increasingly confronting people who are armed in the United States, and they don't know, and in that moment when they're down on the ground, don't know what they're confronting.
Well, look, I would tell you that I have sympathy for officers in general who are confronted with dangerous situations, obviously. This situation should have been handled completely differently, though. I mean, think of it this way. In Louisiana, we're a concealed carry state, so we can carry a gun as long as you have a permit. And if that same 911 call had come through saying that someone had a gun or was brandishing a gun, you know, there are other ways to disarm individuals peacefully and without having to shoot them six times, resulting in their death.
We should say that Alton Sterling did have a gun. The video shows the police officers were moving something from his pocket. We're not sure if that was the gun, but he reportedly had a gun, and he shouldn't have. He's not illegally allowed to have one since he had passed criminal charges. But as we're seeing in the Minnesota case, there are people who are legally allowed to carry guns, and it can still end up in a shooting fatality. What other questions do you and the family have?
Well, you know, we really want to know if we can determine who that anonymous caller was, obviously. But more so, we want to know why the officers took such an aggressive approach when it could have been handled in a much different way.
Do you have questions about the police body cameras?
Well, we certainly have questions about the body cameras. We have questions about the surveillance video. We have questions about the dash cameras, because all those things were supposed to be available and accessible to law enforcement, and we know they confiscated the surveillance video. And so why hadn't that been released to the public? We have two other videos that are out there already. The general public in the world has seen most of what has happened. So why not show everything and let the world determine for themselves?
What about the call for a boycott of local businesses? Won't that hurt the very people in your community who own some of those businesses?
Well, if some see that as a measure that can help us with that situation, then I say fine. But I'm not sure that that is a view shared by everyone. And what I will say is this. Part of the catalyst for the boycott was because the mayor would not turn the investigation over to an independent third party. Now that we do have an independent third party investigating the situation, I'm not sure if that's such as much of a pressing issue.
That's Evan Jordan, State Representative for Baton Rouge. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we'll continue to follow events in Baton Rouge and in Minnesota on these developing stories today. But meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, FBI Director James Comey testifying before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee today about the FBI's investigation into Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server while Secretary of State and the recommendation that no charges be brought against her or anyone else on her staff as a result of that investigation. Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz, chair of the committee, said that the reason for the hearing is the apparent gap between the facts Comey laid out and the conclusion he reached.
It seems to a lot of us that the average Joe, the average American, that if they had done what you laid out in your statement, that they'd be in handcuffs. And they might be on their way to jail, and they probably should. And I think there is a legitimate concern that there is a double standard. If your name isn't Clinton or you're not part of the powerful elite, that Lady Justice will act differently.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith joins us now with more on this. And Tamara, how did Comey respond to that?
Well, he didn't get a chance to respond until quite a bit later because there was a lot of opening statements and back and forth. Later in the hearing, he said that he actually thought it would have been a double standard to prosecute Clinton for what she did based on other cases where people have been prosecuted or not prosecuted.
What is the goal of these hearings? Is there something concrete that could come out of them since the FBI has finished its investigation, recommended no charges, and that the Justice Department has already officially accepted that recommendation? Case closed.
Well, this is a political season. So what could come out of it and what absolutely will come out of it already has come out of it is Republican members of Congress getting James Comey on the record confirming inconsistencies between public statements Clinton made about her email server and what the FBI found in its investigation. And I think we probably have a little bit of audio of Trey Gowdy. He's the South Carolina congressman who led the Benghazi committee interviewing James Comey about this.
Let's listen.
Secretary Clinton said she never sent or received any classified information over her private email. Was that true?
Our investigation found that there was classified information sent.
So it was not true?
Right. That's what I said.
Okay. Well, I'm looking for a little shorter answer, so you and I are not here quite as long. Secretary Clinton said there was nothing marked classified on her emails either sent or received. Was that true?
That's not true. There were a small number of portion markings on, I think, three of the documents.
Secretary Clinton said, I did not email any classified material to anyone on my email. There is no classified material. Was that true?
Now, there was classified material emailed.
Tamara, another issue that has come up and came up in today's hearing is the comparison between what Secretary Clinton did and what happened to her and what General David Petraeus did and what happened to him. Remind us of the differences here as we follow these hearings.
Yeah, this was a really interesting exchange in this hearing. There have been a lot of people who've said, well, Hillary Clinton did something way worse than what David Petraeus did. Well, Director Comey made it clear today he does not agree with that assessment. He said that there was intent with General David Petraeus to remove classified information. And he even said something about hiding something in the insulation of his attic. There was obstruction, he said, though ultimately Petraeus was not charged with obstruction. James Comey made it clear that the Petraeus case was far more egregious than what happened in the Clinton case.
And Comey seemed to stress the difference here between the Clinton case and other cases being that issue of intent and whether the law was broken intentionally. Let's listen here to James Comey.
In our system of law, there's a thing called mens rea. It's important to know what you did, but when you did it, this Latin phrase mens rea means, what were you thinking? And we don't want to put people in jail unless we prove that they knew they were doing something they shouldn't do. That is the characteristic of all the prosecutions involving mishandling of classified information.
Tamara, is this hearing likely to change anyone's mind?
I think a lot of minds are pretty well made up. One notable thing that Comey said is that there is no basis to conclude that Clinton lied to the FBI. Hmm. That, of course, does not mean that this is over.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith, as James Comey, the FBI director, testifies on Capitol Hill just a couple days after deciding that there shouldn't be any charges brought against Hillary Clinton in the email scandal, brouhaha, whatever you want to call it, and the Justice Department accepting that recommendation of no charges. Tamara, we'll keep following this. Thanks.
Indeed.
A pretty calm lunch hour at Francis E. Hammond Middle School in Alexandria, Virginia, one of the wealthiest counties in the country. And still, 76% of students qualify for free or reduced lunch. The National School Lunch Program provides lunch for more than 30 million kids when they're in school. But more than 90% of those kids have to find other options during the summer. They're what the USDA calls food insecure. Now, the USDA has a summer food service program, and we want to take a look at Holmes County, Mississippi, which has 8 of those summer meal sites where kids can go whether or not they're in summer school. It's interesting. Holmes County is the most food insecure and the most obese county in the country. Angel Meeks is the Holmes County School District Superintendent. And Ms. Meeks, you've told us that the problem is that kids are eating processed foods. We want to hear more, but are most of them hungry?
Are they hungry? Maybe, maybe not. Mm. But are they receiving the nutritional value that they need? They're not receiving the nutritional value and they're eating snacks all the time.
Snacks. But when you say processed food, what else do you mean by that?
Frozen foods, bologna, hot dogs, cereal. During the summer, some students are able to continue to access food through the school district. At two of our schools in the district, we have a summer feeding program that allows students to come and have breakfast or lunch, which enables them to continue to receive healthy meals. But during the summer, for those students who are unable to access the schools, then those children rely on what their parents or community persons have for them to eat for breakfast, lunch, or dinner. Sometimes that equates to additional snacks. Sometimes that equates to the additional processed food, frozen foods, or just sandwiches without the vegetables and the whole grains that they need.
It's such a fascinating thing that a school is being asked to, you know, literally feed kids during the summer. What is the biggest problem here? Is it that parents are working?
I think there's a combination. I believe parents are educated and aware of the difference between processed food and whole and healthy food. Some parents work here in Holmes County. Some parents have to work outside of the county, which means that they have to leave home early. But also it has to do with access. The local stores in the Holmes County area are smaller than some of the chain stores that you find in more urban and suburban areas. And so what's available for parents to receive is limited. We have to help offset that. We have some local farmers now that have different markets available to help community persons access healthy food and not only healthier food, but we have some local organic farms here in Holmes County to help.
We've talked about obesity, but what else do you see happening to kids who aren't eating well because they're suddenly for a few months out of the year, they don't have the food they had during the school year?
There are some children who are not obese. They're malnourished on the other side of the fence. It has an impact on their ability to be energetic and lively and engaged in various activities or engaged in learning when they return to school.
Hmm.
We're a small knit community, so generally we look out for one another. If we know of students who may not have access to resources after hours, then our teachers and our administrators, faculty and staff, we just kind of take it up on ourselves to look out for our children.
Are teachers buying food for kids? I mean, the way they buy pencils for them as well?
Sometimes, yes.
Wow.
And, you know, sometimes we find that children make a way. I can think of just one instance. I had a student, had to take him home late one evening. And because of the time, I said, well, we need to make sure he has something to eat. So we stopped by the local convenience store. And that child was looking out for his younger sibling. And, you know, it never dawned on me until I asked him as I was letting him out to go home, and he was like, well, I have to make sure my sister has something to eat. And so that was an eye opener for me to be aware that sometimes we're looking at one individual student when there may be other children who are not even school age who may be going without nutritious meals. It again speaks to our ability as a community to look out for one another, because that young man was looking out for his sister.
That's Angel Meeks, superintendent of the Holmes County School District in Holmes County, Mississippi. Angel, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
There's a new trend aimed at improving your health that involves injecting a mix of water and vitamins into your bloodstream to give you energy and ward off illness. Celebrities like Rihanna have tried it, and Sofia Vergara set up an IV hydration station at her wedding. But is there any science to back this up? Tanya English of Here and Now contributor WHYY's The Pulse reports.
So you saw the waiting room,
yeah.
Obviously. Right here we have two practices. We have my integrative medical practice called Arcana Health, formerly Flat Rock Health, and we also have Restore IV.
Dr. Jason Hartman gives me a tour of his Philadelphia practice. The waiting room looks more like a spa than a doctor's office. There are hardwood floors, natural light, and green plants. Hartman's specialty is osteopathic medicine, using touch to diagnose and treat. His new business, Restore IV, offers clients high-dose vitamins with a needle and an IV bag.
So, come on back.
In the infusion room, you can dim the lights or sit back and watch the huge TV.
We want people to be relaxed and enjoy their experience. Okay.
There's a menu of intravenous drips, sold to boost immunity, help you detox, or turn up your glow. The basic cocktail includes vitamin C, zinc, and B vitamins. If you have a headache, the doctor might add a little magnesium. Sounds good, except I wonder what all those things do.
These are your natural pharmacy. And in chronic diseases, these things can be depleted with stress of, you know, just a stressful lifestyle. And if they become deficient enough, it alters your internal pharmacology enough to possibly manifest as a symptom or a disease.
There are infusion spas with names like Hangover Heaven or the Remedy Room in cities like New Orleans, Las Vegas, even Ibiza, Spain. Those places cater to tourists who party hard. But Jason Hartman cares for a variety of people, including some with serious illnesses like chronic fatigue and migraines. For those patients, he says his IV treatments support healing. Other people are generally healthy and want to stay that way.
We are a bigger, better, faster culture. I want to be a better me. You want to be a better you. And I think this trend reflects that.
One longtime patient is a Philadelphia attorney with two kids and an exhausting travel schedule. Yana Shapiro comes in for 100 milligrams of the drip called immunity protection when she wants to prevent a cold.
Anything to avoid antibiotics.
Or being out of commission.
Absolutely.
Shapiro sits in a reclining, cushy chair and relaxes as she waits for her infusion.
All right, so I'm going to put a tourniquet on. We'll make sure you have a good vein.
A medical assistant prepares to insert a butterfly needle in Shapiro's arm. Like any skin puncture, there's a very small risk of infection or bruising.
All right, so we're getting ready to introduce the needle. You ready? Take a deep breath in. Blow out hard. Good.
Shapiro says she gets a pleasant citrus taste in her mouth as the vitamin C flows into her arm.
I take this time as me time to relax and, you know, kick back and close my eyes for a couple of minutes.
IV treatments cost from $150 to $200. And at Restore IV, everyone pays the doctor's office directly. The treatments are generally covered by insurance. But if you mostly eat your kale and your quinoa, why would you need a boost of vitamins delivered straight to your bloodstream? Skeptical doctors say you probably don't. A healthy gut takes in the nutrients we need. Athar Ali is a researcher and practices integrative medicine at Yale. If IV infusion makes people feel better, he suspects it's a placebo effect.
You know, when your child falls down and scrapes their knee and you give them a kiss, I mean, there's value in that.
Ali and his colleagues tested the most well-known IV vitamin treatment called the Myers cocktail on about 30 people with fibromyalgia, a syndrome that causes muscle pain and fatigue. Half the study participants got IV vitamins. The other half got a saline solution without vitamins.
And the interesting finding was that everyone got better.
People reported less pain and said they were better able to do the things they needed to do every day. Ali says if a treatment is helping someone, there may be reason to use it, even if the fix is 100% placebo effect. But he doesn't offer high-dose intravenous vitamins in his practice.
If people are just using it to feel good or energy boost, I mean, I would say go exercise for 30 minutes and you'll probably get more out of that.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration doesn't regulate or approve vitamin drips, so cautious doctors say know the risks before the needle goes in. For Here and Now, I'm Tanya English.
The Senate is expected to vote today on a bill to establish labeling standards for foods containing genetically modified ingredients. Yesterday, as senators voted to advance the bill, members of the Organic Consumers Association dumped money, real money, from the Senate gallery to protest what they called weak regulations. For more on this, we're joined by Dan Charles, NPR food and agriculture correspondent. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jeremy.
And break it down for us. What exactly would this bill in the Senate do?
So if the bill passed and became law, basically food companies would have to disclose in some way whether that package of food contained ingredients from genetically engineered crops. And the most common of those crops are corn, soybeans, canola, also sugar beets.
And why are opponents so against this? Why are people willing to dump thousands of dollars onto the Senate floor to protest this bill?
Because that information doesn't have to be printed right on the package. It could be, for instance, disclosed through one of those little QR codes, you know, the little square bar type type codes, where if you aimed your smartphone at it and scanned it, then it would bring up the information on your smartphone. If the product came from a small company, they would be allowed just to put a website on the package or a telephone number to call. So the people who've been really pushing for labeling of GMO products and GMO food, they say this is really, you know, this is a bill to let food companies avoid labeling.
And how much does this have to do with the very high-profile state law in Vermont that just took effect last week that would require GMO labeling there in that state?
It has everything to do with it, because this federal law would preempt that Vermont law. Mm. So, you know, if this went into effect, the Vermont requirement would sort of go away, and food companies, instead of putting the Vermont required language right on the package, they could do that, or they could do this, you know, QR code type thing.
Now, this is a topic that you have covered for a long time. We've talked about with you that gets a lot of people very upset. But in May, the National Academies of Sciences released its independent review of thousands of GMO studies and found that genetically modified crops are just as safe to eat as conventional crops. So many would ask, why should they be required to carry a label at all?
Right. And that is the argument, I would say, that's the argument of the anti-labeling side, that this is not necessary for nutritional reasons. And in fact, it's maybe even misleading because people would see it as a warning label. This bill is being presented as a compromise. It's a GMO disclosure, but the food companies don't have to print something that consumers might see as a warning label. And, you know, some groups that are in favor of GMO labeling are also fine with it. They say, OK, people want to know this information. We'll find a way to provide it to them. The Organic Trade Association, the Association of Big Organic Food Companies, is actually supporting it.
And Sam Kass, the Obama administration's former food czar, has said this debate is a waste of time. Would the president sign this bill if it got to him?
Well, I don't know. He might. I suspect he would. Sam Kass's argument is GMOs don't really matter the way, say, you know, federal policies to improve better eating matter. So we should be focusing on that.
Well, we will keep focusing on this debate in the Senate, expected to vote today on this GMO labeling bill. Dan Charles, NPR food and agriculture correspondent, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ron Rash's books might not be your usual light-as-a-breeze summer fare, but we recommend them. As one of the bards of North Carolina, he directs an unflinching gaze at poverty and drug addiction while giving lyrical voice to the beauty of the Appalachians.
Though sunlight tinges the mountains, black leather-winged bodies swing low. First fireflies blink languidly. Beyond this meadow, cicadas rev and slow like sewing machines. All else ready for night except night itself.
Ron Rash reading from his latest novel, Above the Waterfall, out in paperback this week. The waterfall cascades through an upscale fishing resort that's failed to raise the fortunes of the town around it. The story's told by Becky, a ranger in a state park escaping a violent past, and Les, the sheriff consumed by his town's crystal meth addictions, who'll soon have to contend with the water at the resort, which is poisoned, killing the fish that are the main draw. We talked to Ron Rash when Above the Waterfall was published last September. You know, as I was reading, it's such a contrast between the beauty of the area and the ravaging of the crystal meth. But I found myself thinking, well, wait a second. Hasn't your area moved on to heroin like the rest of the country?
Well, unfortunately, OxyContin and heroin are a problem, but meth remains a pretty serious problem. I mean, every time I look in the newspaper, there's been an arrest, usually several.
No. Well, I'd love to hear another reading from you, because until you hear the real descriptions, and we talked to an emergency room doctor in Tennessee, the entire emergency room turned over to treating crystal meth. It's just one of the ugliest addictions, if you can make that characterization. You write about how your character, Les, the sheriff, is making yet another bust with his people. It's a small town, and he knows who this girl is that he's going to find. Do you mind reading for us his thoughts when he makes that bust?
Jarvis cuffed Rodney Greer and sat him on the couch where Ben Lindsay's daughter was passed out. She wore a green halter top and a pair of maroon sweatpants, no shoes. Every other toenail was painted black like piano keys. A thin line of drool ran down the right side of her mouth. Television glamorized meth, even when they tried not to. You didn't smell the moldy food or the vomit or blood, the meth itself burning your nose like ammonia, or how, once you'd arrested them, you turned your face so you didn't smell their rotting mouths. No, TV couldn't give you that.
Yeah, Ron Rash, how do you know about this? Have you, well, yeah, have you gone on raids? Have you, you know...
Actually, a friend of mine who's a sheriff has, and in a sense, he was my resource for this, and he has seen it, and it's, as you say, it's been devastating. I'm hoping it's starting to end in this, I would hope the whole United States. I hope it's going to burn itself out.
Well, I'm wondering if your friend also told you there's a moment where Les and his deputies are just seized with fear, because they realize there's a baby missing, and they all glance toward the microwave and think the worst. Now, we should say it isn't the worst.
No.
But he quits right on the spot. I mean, have you heard those stories?
I've heard some interesting stories. As a matter of fact, one of my students' father was a detective and would actually go on these raids, and she said at night, and I actually use this in the novel, he would get up in the middle of the night and start vacuuming the house. I just thought that was so emblematic of the effect. And one thing that is very important to me is my chief interest is more in the people who are innocent, the children and the parents. Those are the people that I want to focus on so that I don't sensationalize it.
Well, and against this, you paint a picture of the most idyllic landscape, the birds, you know, the bird calls, you know, the names of the flowers, or your character does. Where is that you being channeled in some cases through Becky, the ranger? Or did you have to go out and research that as well? You know, what's the name of that darn thing?
Yeah. Well, I've got friends who are botanists, and I always give them a free copy of the book. They help, and I know some of it myself. But as grim as what we've been talking about sounds, this, I feel like in many ways this is my most upbeat book because which is not raising the bar too high, I understand, but it is a book about wonder as well, and I hope the reader senses that too.
The language. The way you describe this landscape is stunning. You know, the cicadas revving and slowing like sewing machines. Yes, that's exactly what it sounds like. You've got one line that prefaces the story, the moon and ungripped scythe. What is that?
I just thought that would be an image that would actually, you know, where the moon is almost disappearing, just that little curve. Some people might say it's like a hangnail or yeah. fingernail. But I just thought that image by Becky would just kind of trigger a sense that we've got a narrator of these sections who has a sensibility very different from maybe anyone else. Or that's my hope, that she's seeing the world so intensely that she's seeing things in a way that maybe most people can't.
She says things like, "It's been perhaps a decade since saplings and sawbriar rise amid broom sedge." I mean, she's quite lyrical, and she's constantly quoting and mentioning the poet Gerard Manley Hopkins, a Victorian-era poet. She puts up a plaque at the park quoting his line, "How near at hand it was if they had eyes to see it," because she wants so badly for people to come and see the things she sees in the park. How did you get to Hopkins?
Well, he's always been one of my favorite poets, and I've always admired the intensity of his vision. And you hear it in the sounds. And Becky, in many ways, is trying to emulate his sense of language, the intensity of sounds playing off each other, rhythms. I thought, once again, that would fit her, and he would be a poet that she would admire because he, in a sense, is seeing grace in the natural world.
Was his line, or was it hers, "Pentecost of Petrichor"?
That's Becky's.
I had to look that up. And it's fabulous. To explain.
Petrichor is the smell in the air, particularly during a drought time, and right before the storm comes or the rain comes, you can smell it coming.
Yes.
And it's just a beautiful smell if you've sensed it. And I thought for Becky, that was to her, that's just such this beautiful moment.
But you slam those phrases up and Hopkins up against the language of Appalachia. It's a gracious plenty, you know, some of the phrases and words that are maybe disappearing.
And that's, in a way, I think this book is in some ways more about language than any book I've written because I'm really trying to stretch the limits in some ways with Becky, but I'm also trying to be true to the language of the region of the Appalachians, or at least the Appalachians I grew up in, and the beauty there, and language that I don't want to disappear. And I think one way we can save some of that language is by putting it in books.
Yeah, writing about it. Well, we haven't talked a lot about the plot because I want readers to have it unfold for them as it did for us. But just a question, you include environmental activists, a long ago classroom school shooting, which just was chilling, you know, what it might have been like to be in a school like Sandy Hook. What were those references to violence?
Well, I wanted in this book, or maybe not wanted, but the book itself summoned up to, I knew early on that I was going to have two people who had been severely wounded by life. Certainly Becky, who was in the classroom when and saw her teacher get shot and in some ways blames herself for that, and Les, who has not been able to understand his ex-wife's depression. And to me, I hope the book feels like two people who are struggling towards some kind of redemption. And to me, the most important thing about the book is I think in many ways they achieve it.
Well, and the environmental extremist, don't want to flesh it out too much, but there's one in Becky's past. He could have killed people. And then in modern day, in your storyline, you have somebody who poisons water. to get back at someone. So what are you saying?
Well, my first novel was called One Foot in Eden. And I think maybe a lot of my writing is about that. That in that sense, you have this beautiful area, but you also have a kind of place where bad things can happen. One foot's in Eden, but one foot is outside.
Yeah. Ron, thank you so much for once again taking us to your home state of North Carolina through your writing. Thank you.
It was great to talk to you again.
Donald Trump met with Republicans on Capitol Hill this morning in his first meeting with the full GOP caucus in the House. Speaker Paul Ryan said lawmakers appreciated it.
This was the first time just about every one of our members had a chance to actually meet and engage with Donald Trump. So I thought it was great that he came. I'm glad he accepted our invitation. And we had a very good exchange on just lots of ideas and lots of policy issues. So I thought it was a very good meeting. And it's very clear that he is working on putting together a strong general election campaign.
But one congressman in the meeting, Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, said the meeting was awkward because Trump said things that apparently made him shake his head in disbelief. Joining us now, Paris Denard, here now political analyst and a GOP strategist. Hi, Paris.
Hey, Jeremy, how are you?
I'm doing well, and I want to get to Donald Trump in a minute, but I first, because this has been such a big week in terms of the Clinton emails, I wanted to get your thoughts on that as a GOP strategist about the decision not to prosecute Clinton by the Justice Department. Do you think that Republicans should continue to talk about this issue, even though from the Justice Department's perspective, it's case closed?
The GOP should talk about this until November. This is a huge deal. It's a big issue. And it's not so much that the FBI and the Justice Department decided not to prosecute her or file charges against her, but it's more so what he said, the FBI director said. He said she used horrible judgment. And really, he discredited almost every single thing that she said that as to why she used this email and this server. And so it speaks to trustworthiness, it speaks to credibility, it speaks to character. And these are issues that progressives, Trump and Sanders supporters, as well as these independents, look at Hillary Clinton and say, I don't know if I can trust her. I don't know if I can believe what she says. When the FBI director comes out and pretty much says that you've done a lot of bad things and weren't telling the truth, that's not a good day or week or several months are going to be for Hillary Clinton.
So if it's such a good idea for Republicans to talk about this, why isn't Donald Trump talking about this? And let me tell you what I mean here. Last night, he gave this rally in Cincinnati. And rather than just focus on the Clinton emails, he started talking about scandals that he's involved in, including his recent praise of Saddam Hussein. Here he is.
Then I said again, Saddam Hussein is a bad guy. But he did one thing well. He killed terrorists. And I was just asked a question by the Cincinnati Inquirer inside. Mr. Trump, is it true that you love Saddam Hussein? Essentially, like sort of that, you know. I said, that's not what I said.
Paris, what do you think? Why is he talking about these other things?
Well, for the past 24, 48 hours when the mainstream media has been hammering him saying that he, quote unquote, praised Saddam Hussein, I think he has the ability, he needed to address this issue or this perceived controversy and say what he actually meant and what he actually said. And so when you're attacked, you have to fight back. And I think that's exactly what he did. And I think a lot of people would agree that his statement was actually factual as it relates to what Saddam Hussein was doing relating to terrorists in Iraq.
Although it still sort of makes you wonder why you would need to bring that up at this point. Why bother going down the road of praising Saddam Hussein?
But well, he didn't praise Saddam Hussein. I take issue with that. But I think when you're the president of the United States, you're running to be president of the United States, you have to be able to talk about a whole host of things like the international affairs, national security, as well as Hillary Clinton's email situation.
Well,
look at Hillary.
he also has been talking about something else that's gotten him into trouble, which is this tweet that went out with a six-pointed star that was called anti-Semitic. Yeah. Here he is talking about that in Cincinnati last night.
To me, it was just a star. But when I really looked, it looked like a sheriff's star. But CNN started this dialogue going, it's the Star of David. And because it's the Star of David, Donald Trump has racist tenets. These people are sick, folks. I'm telling you, they're sick.
Paris, what do you think of this one? Do you buy that there was nothing anti-Semitic about it?
Yeah, what I do know, Jeremy, is that over almost 100 people from the National Diversity Coalition for Trump came to the RNC and had a meeting last Friday. And this was a very diverse group of people. There were Jewish Americans there, African Americans there, Hispanic Americans, a lot of Asian Americans that were there all in support of Mr. Trump that flew all over the country to be there to support him. And then when you looked in June, they looked at the figures and said the Trump campaign raised $55 million from 400,000 supporters. 94% of them gave under the $200 limit. So when you look at that, that tells me that the Republicans, and there's a diverse group of Republicans who are supporting Mr. Trump and do not buy into what the liberal media tries to portray, because they're going to do this. In order for Hillary Clinton to win and succeed, they have to continue to label him as a racist, a bigot, and all of these things that are not actually true.
But there are also Republicans that aren't, at least if not supporting him, that they don't want to be his VP, that we've learned about this week. Yeah. Bob Corker, the senator from Tennessee, looks like Iowa Senator Joni Ernst as well. Just a few seconds, but who do you think it is going to be, Paris, the VP?
I'm not sure who it's going to be, but I tell you the type of characteristics that's going to be is someone that has experience, that has worked with the Congress and has the executive experience. It's going to look to be someone like a Cheney was to Trump. I'm sorry, Cheney was to Bush and a Biden was to Obama.
That sounds like Newt Gingrich to me. We will see.
I didn't say, we'll
Paris
see.
Denard.
It won't be me.
It won't be you, Paris.
Unfortunately.
Here and now, political analyst and a GOP strategist. Thanks as always.
All right, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Although if he's asked, he'd serve. I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.